Good afternoon. So last time we talked about building processors for our simple instruction set Y86, and we talked about first that we needed some state components. So we needed some registers, like most notably for the program counter. We need to know what instruction are we running. We needed a register file to hold our RAX, RBX up to R14. We needed memories, so we needed an instruction memory which held our instructions. We had a data memory, which is what our memory to register and register to memory move instructions use, and also push and pop. And all these components worked in this uniform way where when we were doing reads on them, they always read within a clock cycle. Within the clock cycle, we got the value that was in the register, or we put in an address and got the value that was at that address from a memory, or we put in a register number, we got the value that was in the register identified with that number from the register file. So all reads happened within a clock cycle, and all writes, when we modified a register or modified a location in memory, always happened at the end of a clock cycle. So we had our rising edge of a clock, and the rule was that in this area, the reading happened and computation, and right at this rising edge is where writing happened. So in addition to our components which stored state, we also had to make decisions. We had to do a different thing for NOP instructions versus jump instructions. And our circuit level tool for doing this was a MUX, something which we had a select input, which we would compute, for example, based on the opcode, and we would use that to connect the appropriate input to the output. And based on these, we were building a simple single cycle processor. So when we say single cycle, what we mean is that every instruction takes exactly one clock cycle. That we start the instruction with a rising edge, when our PC gets written with a new value, and once that happens, we start executing the instruction at that PC, and we set it up so at the next rising edge, we write all the modifications that that instruction does all at once. And our rule for our processor design right now is going to be that we're going to do everything in this single cycle design, so every instruction is going to take exactly one cycle. If the instruction seems to like it needs to do multiple steps of work, well, we only have a cycle to do it. So we're going to figure out a way to do it in that one cycle without writing a value and reading it back, because we can only write once. So any questions on what we covered last time? And these concepts. Okay, so I believe last time when we finished, we were building this move CPU here. So we have our instructions handled. And the idea is that, well, all these instructions, they need to read from these two registers. Some of them don't need all of those registers, but we'll read anyways and ignore some of the values. We don't, reading extra stuff is not harmful. So for all these instructions, we read from the two register numbers. And then we make a choice about what to store in the destination register. So sometimes we take the value of the source register. So for an RR move Q, we're taking this source register value, and that's what gets connected through our MUX into the destination. And sometimes we have an immediate to register move. So we read this register A, which happens to be register 15, which, if you remember how a register file works, reads a 0. But we don't care because we're not using that line. We're going to take this wire, which comes from the instruction, which is this V value in the instruction. And that's what we're going to pass through and put on the register file's input. So when the rising edge of the clock happens, we write V into, in this case, register B. And then we have this last instruction, MR move Q. So for this, we need to read from memory at D plus RB. So we need the value of the register RB. So we put in the register number here. So we get it out here. We take that value, and we need to add it to D, which is from the instruction. So we take that value from the instruction, put it into the our ALU, set to add, and that's our input to our data memory. So our data memory within the same cycle reads memory at that location and then writes the value out, and then that value will be passed through the MUX as the destination register. So a subtlety here is that this instruction uses RA and these instructions use RB, and no, that is not a typo. So that means that for IR move Q, we want to select RB, and for MR move Q, we want to select RA, so we need another MUX here to set this appropriate destination register number, whether it's RA or RB. And that's going to be set similarly to our MUX, which controls what value do we write based on the type of instruction. We'll also choose what register do we write to based on the type of instruction. So any questions about this? Yes?
So you have an immediate line there to do the offset. If you wanted to offset both RB and RA in that last instruction, you need more than...
So the question is, if I wanted to have an instruction like MR move Q D RB, and you want it to be you want it to offset RA, so you actually want a memory to memory move? Is that what you're looking for? What instruction do you want to run?
Is memory to memory legal?
So the question is, memory to memory legal? No, that doesn't exist. And as you observe, if it existed and we were consistent, if we had a memory to memory move, we'd need space for two D's in the instruction, so we'd need much bigger instruction. And we'd also have a bit of trouble with our data memory only taking in one address. So that would be very hard to implement with the components we have so far. Other questions? Okay, so now that we have this CPU which does all our move to register instructions. Oh, there's one more detail that is important, is that sometimes we need to add 2 for RR move Q. And sometimes for everything else we need to add 10 to get the address of the next instruction, because if we have an RR move Q followed by say an IR move Q, then right here we'll have a 3 and then a 0 and then an F and so on, and that's where we want to advance the program counter pointer. Okay, questions? Okay. So now we have a processor that does all our move to register instructions. And let's add the remaining move instruction, which is move from a register to memory. So what do we need to add to make this work? I just want to incrementally add these instructions. So I'm just going to say, OK, what do I need that's not here to happen for our register to memory move. Any ideas about things that we're missing that we probably should add if we want to register to memory move? Or can we just implement this, assuming like we change convert opcode to just handle number 4 in addition to number 2 for our 3 and 5? Yeah. Okay, so it looks like we can only write to registers. So what should we add? Some way to write to memory. And if you remember how our memory works, we want to put an input into here. So we're going to need to put an input into there. And where should that input come from? What value do we want to write to memory? RA, as people are saying. So and this line here contains the value that we read from register specified by RA. So we're going to take that 64-bit value, put it into our memory, so on. So any other changes we need? Any other things that, you know, we need to add to make things work? So, one thing you should think about is what should this mux do for the RM move Q instruction? So let's go through our options we have now. We could have the mux output the immediate, which is going to be D, and send it to the register file and have it written into either register A or register B. That's not something the register to memory move instruction does. It doesn't modify register A or register B with the displacement. We could potentially have it write register A to either register A or register B. So that would technically be an option, but usually not a very intuitive one. Or we could have it write the output of memory, which is not going to work. So technically, we could connect on this register to memory move. We could connect this here and write to register A. And what we're doing here is we're reading from register A and writing to register A. Would implement this instruction, basically, but that's pretty non-intuitive, so that's probably not what we're actually going to do. And if you remember, our register file took a special register number to say, don't write. Register number 15 did that. So what we're probably going to do instead is rather than worry about this mux, we're going to pass register number 15 in this case to say don't write to any register, and then we don't have to worry about reading from the same register or writing. We just say don't write to any register, because unlike all the other instructions on this list, our move queue shouldn't modify any registers. The most straightforward way to do that is to pass register number 15, because remember all writes to register number 15 are ignored. So now it doesn't matter what this mux that chooses the value to write has, because we're not going to change any registers anyways. So there's one more thing we're missing here. And to think about that, let's think about what's going to happen on our RR move queue instruction. When RR move queue is running, we're going to read from register B. We're going to add that to whatever is in memory after the RR move queue instruction and send that to the data memory along with the value of register A. And RR move queue, what is it supposed to do with memory? Yeah.
Should do like nothing.
Should do nothing to memory. And right now, there's nothing on this picture which distinguishes what rmoveq does with memory versus what rmoveq does with memory. Now, if rmoveq was just reading from memory, that probably wouldn't be a problem. We can read values that we don't care about, as long as we ignore them. But if it's writing to memory, well, that's a problem. We don't want our moving from RAX to RAX to suddenly change a random memory location. So we need to take advantage of the write-enable input to our memory and actually do something with it, because we don't always want to write to our memory. So we're going to connect that. And this is going to be some function of the opcode. Basically, if we have opcode 4, we're going to set that to 1. Otherwise, we're going to set it to 0. Don't write. I don't care what your inputs are. I don't want memory changing. So any questions on this idea? So now that we have this processor diagram, which has all our types of move instructions, let's just work through this to make sure people are clear on what's happening here. So let's say we're running an rrmoveq instruction from R8 to R9. In that case, our PC contains the address of this instruction. We put that into the instruction memory, and we get out the instruction encoding plus some extra bytes at the end that we don't care about. Those extra bytes go down this immediate line, but it's not used, so it doesn't matter. We also get 8, the register number here, and 9. And we read both those registers. We take the value of R8. And we've set up this mux to pass through the top input. So we put the value of R8 as the input to the register file, along with along with having this labeled wrong. Should be here, and this should be OX9. Good work, me. So along with putting in register number 9 as the destination register number. So when that rising edge of the clock happens, we're set up to write R8 into value of R8 into register number 9. And we're also set up to write PC plus 2 into here. So we have PC plus 2 on this line. And if we have, say, iRemoveq, here we have, we take our instruction. This is what we get from the instruction memory as bytes. We take the immediate out of it, and that's what we pass through our destination. It turns out we read from register 15, which gives us 0, and register 8, but it doesn't matter because we don't use the values we read, and we write to register 8 this value here. And we also increment the PC by 10 to go to the next instruction. So any questions on what's going on here? Yeah?
Whenever you use immediates, does the register 15 appear?
Question is, whenever you use immediates, does the register 15 appear? No. So for example, if we're doing an rmoveq, we have an immediate, there's no register 15.
Then when does register 15 appear?
So the question is, why is register 15 here? Yeah. And that's because it's just this part of the instruction, the same part we got our A from, that's what's going to be on that wire, because it's just physically connected in the same way as for an rmoveq, so you get 15. So if we take our move queue, we have the same, so we have our register number, our move queue, register number 8 and 9. We get value of R8 as input to the data input of the data memory, and R9 plus that immediate as the address input, and this write enable should be 1. And we'll actually write, and this again happens at the end of the cycle. So these are the inputs set up just as the rising edge of the clock happens, so the data memory actually does the write. Yes? When do I use plus 2 versus plus 10? So the rule is this is plus 2 because we want, if the PC was pointing here, we want it to end up pointing here, and this is 1 byte, 2 bytes. Plus 10 is for this, we want to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And that's for all of those other instructions. Yes?
You mentioned earlier something about reads, like you don't care about what you read, but like where do you read stuff?
So the question is, where do we read stuff? So here, we pass 8 to the register file, so we end up reading the value of R8 and the value of R9. We actually use it in this case. But that also happens here. So here, we're passing 8 to source B, so we read the value of R8. So this line here has the value of R8. And the way our IR move queue works, write enable will be 0 on the data memory. And we might end up reading from R8 plus 0x1234 in memory, but based on how this looks, that wouldn't be a problem because its output goes to this bottom input of this MUX, which we don't use, because that's not what's connected to the MUX's output. Other questions? And I guess our last instruction here. So this is our MR move queue. So here we got the immediate and the value of R9 or R8. Did I MR move queue from R? Yep. Okay. Great work, me. The value of, I remember the order in which MR move queue takes its arguments, and remember that this is R8 here, and this is R9. So we get, so here, because MR move queue is weird, RA is 8, so we put an 8 here, we read from R8, and don't read from R8 and don't do anything with that because we're writing to it. We also put R8 in as the destination input, and our other the destination value is going to be the result of the data memory, which is reading from the value of R9 plus R immediate. And that's what's set up. So the inputs, these two inputs to the register file are set up when the rising edge of the clock happens, so that's the value that gets written. Any questions on anything on this diagram before we move on to a different topic? Okay, so we have been describing hardware by drawing pictures. And drawing pictures is a fine way to describe hardware, but it's not super convenient. And I mean, you could design a processor with pictures, and there are tools that are for designing processors where you basically draw pictures and software, and then this gets turned into a processor. But these are not commonly used if you're actually building a processor. This is not, like, they're used for other types of circuits more often, but for processors, there's generally not what people end up using because it ends up being awkward to deal with these commercial tools that do this. These are known as schematic capture tools. If you took DLD, you may have used Logisim, which is basically one of them, but not a commercial one, more of an educational one. But there are commercial programs like that, but they typically don't handle the sort of complexities we care about in processors. So instead of drawing pictures to make processors, we're going to deal with text-based descriptions. That rather than having pictures like this, we're going to write a description in text. It's going to sort of be a text-based programming language for hardware. And like a programming language, we'll have abstraction. So this will let us not be concerned with, like, how do we build arithmetic operations from gates? We in this class are going to say that someone else did that for you. You're just going to use the arithmetic operation that's provided. And we'll assume that the implementation of this tool, if we were building a processor, would compile down to a description of gates to handle that. And similar for, like, building registers from transistors, or memory from transistors, or muxes from gates, that whatever tool we use will specify these high-level things, and the compiler for our programming language will take those high-level things and convert them into a description of, here's where I want you to put a transistor, another transistor, wire them up like this, and that's going to be the compiler's output for this programming language for hardware. So that we're going to write a program, and it's going to turn into a description of how to build a physical thing that executes that program. And also, conveniently, these things that are abstracted are generally not topics for this course. They're more things for DLD or various ECE courses. And our next series of assignments, starting with lab next week, is going to be using a particular tool we have for this course. Our tool is HCLRS, which is built just for this course. It is a hardware description language, but it really assumes you're making a processor. To make your assignments more convenient, we've baked in some assumptions that only make sense if you're making a processor, not just a processor, but a processor that's going to execute y86-64. If you've read the textbook, which you should have for the pre-quiz for this week, you may have noticed that the textbook has its own hardware control language, HCL. Ours is a little bit different, hopefully in ways which, you know, improve things and give you more flexibility, but it's a little bit different, and I'll talk about those differences in a bit. So let's look at how we can make some simple CPUs in this hardware description language. And because it's for building processors, I'm not going to start with other circuits. I'll start with CPUs, because that's the only thing it's for building. Just has some things hard-coded. So here's this first CPU I built. This is executing NOPs. So our NOP instruction takes up one byte. We put it in the instruction memory and then ignore it, because it's always a NOP and we don't care about any other type of instruction. We'll just assume it's also a NOP. So in our hardware description language, one thing we're going to need is we need a PC, which I've labeled as the PC here. So I need to define that register. And in our language, we're going to have a way of declaring, like we declare a variable, a register. And the syntax is going to be a little fun. This is an example of that. So I've chosen two letters, a lowercase letter p and an uppercase letter f, and I've declared the PC as a 64-bit value, and that value is initially 0. So you may wonder, okay, what's this p and f thing? What is that for? Why do I just not say register the PC? So there are two signals associated with this register. There's this wire that comes out of the register, which remembers the output, which is the current value. and there's the wire which comes in, which is the value we're going to have after that next rising edge, when all the writes happen. And the input end of this is the lowercase letter that comes first, and the output end is given the uppercase letter that comes next. So our input is little p underscore the PC, and our output is big F underscore the PC. And here I have a line which implements this add one circuit. So we take the output of the program counter register, which is called big F underscore the PC. We add one to it. We can just write an expression and our programming language compiler will figure out what to do as far as, you know, if we were building a processor, turning that into gates. And then I say that that's going to be connected to the input to the register. And that's how I've specified that part of the circuit. So questions about this so far? Yes. Why did I pick P and F? Those were arbitrary choices. When we talk about stages, that's why I picked F. And I chose lowercase p mostly to emphasize that they don't have to be the same. When we talk more about pipelining, we'll have a reason to pick particular letters to make things clear what's going on. But as far as the HCLRS is concerned, it doesn't care what letters you use. You know, you can use any letters you like, but probably like naming variables, you want to choose them in such that they make sense to you. Yes?
Do all names have to be two characters?
Do all the names of the register, of these sets of registers, have to be two characters? Yes. Yes, you have a lower, and it has to be, in fact, a lowercase letter and an uppercase letter. Yes.
What's the point of the second line? .pc64.
Okay, so the question is, what about this other stuff? And that's in the register declaration. So this says it's a 64-bit value. That our program counter is 64 bits. We can have arbitrary size registers. Not arbitrary, but anything up to 128 bits. So more than you need. And the equals zero, this says value when CPU starts. So the zero is the initial value, the value when we've reset the system and starting it from scratch. It's going to contain a zero, so that's what's going to output at the beginning when our clock is just starting. Other questions? Yeah?
Only letters allowed when we're registering registers.
The question in naming registers, are only letters allowed?
Yeah.
You can, for the name of the this name, you can use underscores too.
And then, like, can we use like register P9 or?
For the other thing, it's only letters. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So there's one more thing on this picture I haven't done, and that's this instruction memory, connecting the PC to the instruction memory and then ignoring the value we're reading. So let's also do that. So the instruction memory is a built-in component and the names of its wires are fixed. The input to it is called just PC. That is just the input to the instruction memory because the current instruction you're reading is PC. It's always wired to the instruction memory, and its output is called I10 bytes. And the reason I have used this is that this instruction memory, because this language is designed for building processors only, must always be used or else it is a compiler error. So we have to connect it to something. So in this case, I connect it to my counter. So there's one other component which we must use in order for this programming language to compile, and that's something called stat. So remember, we talked about the stat register, which was the processor status, and this is what we're going to use when we simulate your processor to figure out how long do we run the simulation. So there are two constants that you can supply to this that we'll talk about mostly. One is stat AOK, which says continue, that run for another cycle. Another is stat halt, which stops the processor, in our case, stops our simulation of the processor, and you can look at, like, how did things finish up. And this is what we end up as our NOP CPU. So questions on this? Okay, so we've written a NOP CPU, and we're missing something here. So in order to run this with our implementation of HCLRS, we need a program to run on this CPU. Because it's built for running CPUs, it needs something to put in the instruction memory. So we need a program in memory. And that's going to be represented as a file with the extension .yo. You can think of this as y86 object. And along with the copy of HCLRS that you will download for the lab, there's a tool which converts a YS file, which you can think of as y86 assembly, to a .yo file. There's also, and I'll talk about it later, a reference interpreter for .yo file. So they have their own processor simulator written by your textbook authors that tells you what is an that interprets the assembly, the compiled assembly file, the assembled file, I should say, and tells you, here's what we think a y86 processor would do on this, which you might find handy later on when you implement this. So I'm going to want to create a program. So let's move on to the scary live demo portion. Scary for me, not you. Okay, so I just downloaded this hclrs.tar, which was linked off the lab write-up for next week. I've untarred it and I've extracted it. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to run make to build everything. And now I want to take my NOP CPU and run it. So I have my NOP CPU here in a file with the extension .hcl. And I'm going to want to run it on some program. So I need some assembly file, some program to load. So here is my program. Okay, there's my y86 assembly program. It's a very simple program. And I need to turn that into a .yo file so I can assemble it and we can load it into memory. So one way I can do that is with tools ys nops.ys. And if I look in my current directory, I have a nops.yo, which is actually a readable file. The format here is something you can read that's handy for debugging. If you want to know what's going on, you can see what's in the file. If I in addition to running YAS directly, the Y86 assembler, I could also use make. So if nops.yo doesn't exist, so it's not here, I can run make nops.yo, and make will look for a .ys file and run Y86 tools YAS for me, creating the same file. Okay, so now I want to actually run my HCL file that I have here, loading that program and running it. I have my CPU that can run NOPs. So let's do that. So the program that interprets my HCL file is called .hclrs in the current directory. And I'm going to pass the CPU I want to run and the file I want to run on. Okay, now let's do that. That seems, and If you look at the top of this output, it says timed out after 9,999 cycles. So it didn't stop. It just kept going until it timed out, until it ran out of cycles. It also printed out a bunch of stuff about what was happening. And, you know, and so why did this seem to run forever? If we just scroll up, like, it ran for 10,000 cycles, and then it stopped because HTLRS is configured to, after 10,000 cycles by default, stop running. You can change that by supplying an argument, so maybe you can try C. Maybe it stops after 100,000 cycles. Apparently not. So what happened? Yeah?
You had the status in AOK the whole time, so it never had a fault, maybe?
Yeah, so we, if we look at our nopcpu.hcl, we set stat equals stat AOK. We don't actually check for halt instructions. Like, we consume everything's a nop. So of course we don't stop, we just keep going. And yes, we only loaded this tiny program, but something is in memory at location 5, and location 6, and location 7, and location 8. And in fact, it's zeros, and we happily read those zeros and kept going. Because we didn't actually do anything with the instruction memory's output that would make us stop conditionally. Okay. So, I guess I should mention, so if you run HTLRS, it has some options. Most of them you won't use much. One of them is check, to just check your syntax. We'll talk about this debug option later. And there's a quiet option, and so on. So one thing I'd like to note is if you look carefully at the output we had, there were some things that are useful. So one thing is that at every cycle, it outputs the values of the registers. So I had my .pc register. Every cycle, it tells me what's the value of that right now. So that's useful if you want to figure out what's going wrong. And if we look back at our output up here, you can see that our PC ended up being, you know, hex 1869D, then 69C, and it was keeping incrementing up. We also have at each cycle the value which was loaded from the instruction memory. And for your convenience, we have a disassembly of that thing that was loaded. So it's not how my processor interpreted it. This is just, we know you're running YAD6, so the tool interprets it as a YAD6 instruction and disassembles it to show you what it should be. In addition, we have the values in memory here. I guess I should do, that's a bit more readable. We have the values in memory. In this case, this is saying here that address 03 hex has the value 10 in hex. Where there's spaces missing, it's zeros and was never set. We also have the contents of all the registers at every cycle. So questions about anything in this output? Okay. So now we want to actually like execute, say, halts correctly. So we're going to want to have a mux. And we're going to choose, based on whether we have a NOP instruction or a HALT instruction, what we do. So we're going to make a CPU that can correctly execute HALTs, meaning that it actually looks at the opcode and does something with it. That thing is either HALT or not. And to HALT, we pass this stat HALT value to the stat line. And that is what we end up. And that means that when that happens, the simulator is going to say, we're done. I'm going to print out the last values and say, the program's finished. So in HCLRS, we're going to use what the book, our muxes are implementing what the book calls a case expression. And the form of this is that we have square brackets, and we have a list of cases where we have a condition, colon, a value, and then a semicolon. And these conditions are evaluated as if in order. So here, if x is 5, so first we say, is x 5? If so, the result should be 1. Then we say, is x in 0, 6? If so, the result should be 2. If we're still going, if x is 2, greater than 2, the result should be 3. And otherwise, the result should be 4. 1 is true, and our truth works like in C. So notably, if x is 3, it's not equal to 5, it's not in 0 and 6, and it's greater than 2, so we get 3. If x is 0 or 6, we get 2, because that comes first, even though x greater than 2 is satisfied by 6, too. So any questions on this? And you may notice that this syntax means that you don't have to worry about this extract opcode box. Like when we previously talked about it looked like we had to, oh no, change like 7 into 1 to make the right inputs of the mux happen. This is sort of abstracted away for you, that we write these expressions and assume that our programming language will figure out how to construct muxes and their inputs to make this happen. And this is basically the sort of thing people do with real processors, is that this sort of logic is something that we can automate. But we do need to actually figure out where the opcode is. And if you remember what I told you earlier, is that we have this input here is i 10 bytes. And this is an 80-bit value. Why 80 bits? Because our biggest instruction is 80 bits. That's 10 bytes. So we always read 10 bytes from the instruction memory. Sometimes we don't use all of it. In this case, we only want to use 1 byte of it. And in fact, we only really care about the top 4 bits of that byte were the, you know, where we distinguish between 0 for HALT and 1 for NOP. So we need some way of taking this 80-bit value and getting that 0 or 1 or something else. And we have a special operator for doing that. And basically, if you have a value, you can take a range of bits, so in this case, bit 2 through 9, to including bit 2, not including bit 9. So we get the value with bits 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, so a 6-bit, or 7, yeah, 7-bit value, bit value out of that. And in this numbering, the least significant bit is bit 0, and when we read from memory, we interpret the bytes in a little endian order. This is a point of incredible confusion for people of like, what bits do we get? So we've read our instruction, so we have our NOP, and then we have a bunch of extra stuff in front of it in memory. And we've taken this series of bytes, so this is our byte 0, this is our byte 1, this is our byte 2, all the way up to, this is our byte 9, and we've interpreted this as a little endian number. So we have our byte 9 as the most significant part of that number all the way down to our byte zero as the least significant part of the number, because this is how little endian numbers work. And we want to select the bits that correspond to this part. So what bits are those? What by this numbering, what set of bits should we choose? And here is bit 0, and this is bit 79. Yeah.
1 to 2.
So you want to take bits 1 to 2. So remember that each of these, this is a nibble. So this is each of these numbers is 4 bits. So our 010 is actually 0001, 0000. So you have the right idea, but you need to account for them being 4 bits. So you have a revised answer. Four to eight, exactly. So this would be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And because it's exclusive of the end of the range, we want exactly 4 to 8. So, yes, this really confuses people. So I'm going to go through a few more examples. Let's talk about, let's say we have a push instruction. So we have push RBX, and it's encoded as these 2 bytes. So we have A is the opcode for push, F, 2F. So these are our 2 bytes. So the first memory location contains our opcode. The second contains that. But this is byte 0 becomes the least significant part of the number. And we also have some stuff off here that we don't care about. So if we want to select parts of this instruction, we're going to choose bit numbers between 0 and 16. So if we want to select the opcode, it's still going to be 4 to 8. If we want to select this register number here, it's going to be 12 to 16. Even though the encoding in memory looks like this. And so overlaid on here. So byte 0 is bits 0 through 7. So the least significant bits of that are bits 0 through 4, and this is why people get confused. And the most significant bits, the thing we write first in that byte, is bits 4 through 8. And our next byte is bits 8 through 16. So the most significant part of that, the thing we write first, RA, is bits 12 through 16. And the least significant part is bits 8 through 12. Okay, so any questions about this? Yeah. Sure. So our top byte is bits 0 through 7. Our next byte is going to be 8 through bits 0 through 7. Our next is going to be 8 through 15. So if we want to select the least significant 4 bits, we do 0 through 4 because it's exclusive of the ends to get 0, 1, 2, and 3. And that would be the part where we have the condition and function codes. If we want to select the most significant bits, which is where we have the opcode, that would be 4 through 8. It's like 4, 5, 6, and 7. That's the most significant bit of byte 0. Byte 1 is 8 through 16, 8 through 15 inclusive. And if we want to select the most significant part of that, we'll use 12 through 16, select 12, 13, 14, and 15. And that's where RA is. we want to select the least significant part of FASTA is going to be 8 through 12, 8, 10, 11, 8, 9, 10, 11. That's going to be where our B is. And this, yes, collectively here, this is going to be 8 through 16. And similarly, this is going to be 16 through 24, and so on. But within each byte, you have to think about start from the least significant is the lowest number. Okay. Any other questions? Yes?
Why would it step for byte one, it went from like 12 to 16 to 8 to 12, but to byte 0, it went 4 to 8 to 0 to 4?
So we have, so here, this is, well, this part is 4 to 8, just like this part is 12 to 16. I just did them in a different order. So they're paired together if you take the same offset. Okay, so given that we know that, now we want to take our CPU and implement a mux. So we're going to extract the opcode, which we've established as bits 4 through 8, from the output of the instruction memory. And we're going to use that to control this mux. And if the opcode is not, which we have a convenient constant predefined, so you don't need to look it up the table, you could just use all capitals NOP, and that's the opcode value for NOPs. If so, we get stat AOK. The opcode is halt, we get stat halt. And we have a default case here where we're going to send stat INS. INS stands for invalid instruction. You may wonder why it does that. We're just being consistent with the book. So this is invalid instruction. So questions about this? Yeah.
You always have to have a default case.
The question is, do you always have to have a default case? For HTLRS, yes. This is a difference from the book. And we added this because it turns out that a very common error is not having a default case, and then the mux has a value, and you get very confused, because usually that value defaults to something which might kind of make sense. So this is our NOP jump CPU, and we can go back and actually run that. So we can look at, or NOP halt CPU rather. So there's our NOP halt CPU, just written down in code. And I can take that NOP halt CPU and I can run it on my nops.yo. And behold, it terminates. You might say, wait, nops.yo didn't contain any halts. But remember that memory that we didn't set is initialized to zeros. We read from that memory. We end up reading zeros. Zeros is halt. So we get a halt instruction, which we correctly interpret here. And you can see that in this output here, we loaded from address 5, which is off the end of our memory, and we read a byte of 0, which was a halt, and we in fact halted on that, and it tells us that we halted with all these register values and PC equal to 6, which is what it was set to at the same time we halted. That was the input to the PC register in the same cycle where we decided to halt. So any questions on this? And since we have a short output, I'd also like to note that there's an option to get abbreviated output. So if we pass dash Q or minus minus quiet, we just get the final state. And that also works for our original CPU, but our final state there is timed out. Okay, so now we have a CPU that can run nop and halt. And we can continue this sort of process and reproduce some of the toy processors we made earlier. So remember, we started off by, when we were introducing MUXes, looking at a jump CPU. So I'm going to give a definition of a jump CPU here. And I've done some things to make things more convenient for me. So there's a whole bunch of places I need this top of the instruction here, this opcode. And rather than type i10 bytes of 4.8 a whole bunch of times, I'm defining a wire named iCode, which is 4 bits long, because that's the size of the opcode. And I'm connecting something to that wire and then using the value of that wire in a whole bunch of places. So I'm using it to decide what is the input to the program counter register, which is this MUX. And I'm using it to decide what's the input to the stat register. Is it A-OK or is it halt? Or is it invalid instruction? And so on. I also define a convenient value for this dest wire. So I give it a name and make it 64 bits, and I extract the mediate from the instruction, which is bits 8 through 72 for a jump. And then I can use that dest later without, you know, tediously having that mixed in and making it harder to read. So, like, I could have done this without these wires, which are basically variables, but I used them. I also used a wire valp as the thing I set my next PC value to. You may ask, why did you choose such a bad name? I chose it because it's the same name the textbook uses. So we have that. Okay, another note here. As I mentioned, we require MUXes to always have a default case. This is unlike the book. So here, I've given a default case, which is just some sentinel value. And this means that when inevitably I have a bug and somehow that value gets used, and like we set the PC to bad, 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 I could be like, oh, I probably used that default case in my MUX. So I recommend setting a default cases that will be very obvious if they're used and when you don't expect them to be. And in this case, we're assuming that if we have an instruction that isn't one of the ones listed, we would set stat to invalid instruction, which would stop the processor. And the simulator would say program halted because of invalid instruction. So I have my not jump CPU, so we can also run that. So I have prepared earlier my copy of that not jump CPU, and I can do things with it. Should mention the check command, so I can see that it has possibly correct syntax. But I need a file for this to run. I don't have any files with jumps yet. So I just wrote an assembly file to test it out. So I'm going to convert this into a .yo file that we can load into the CPU. And if we look at that file, we see it got assembled. We have the instructions with the addresses filled in. The assembler did that for us. We didn't need to compute them by hand. And I can actually run my not jump CPU on that. and it ran for 7 cycles. And if we look up at what the output was, we ran the NOP, then we ran jump to address 13, and then we, with PC equals 13, we ran jump to address X, hexadecimal A, and then with PC of hexadecimal A, we ran jump to address hexadecimal 1C, and then we ran a NOP at address 1C, a NOP at address 1D, and a NOP at halt at address 1E. So you can see that, you know, that if we look at carefully at our assembly file, we could verify whether or not that was the correct execution. Assembled file, I should say. So another way we can have to help verify that things are right is that the book authors have supplied a simulator called YIS, which I can run on this.yo file. And if I do that, it tells me it took 7 steps, it halted at address 1E, which if we look was where the halt instruction we ran was, so that seems right, and it made no changes to registers or memory. Like nothing in this program touched memory or registers, which makes sense because we didn't implement writing to memory or registers. So there are also some other tools which you might find useful when developing HCLRS programs. One of them is that there is a debugging flag. So I can pass debug or dash D to this, and it gives me output telling me the value of all my wires at every cycle. So I can see that when I started out, I10 bytes was set to this result, you know, this value. This is the actual value in I10 bytes, which had the NOP, has the NOP at the end, but we also read, you know, we read 10 bytes, we have the rest of it. And I have a table of all the wires I defined and what their values were at the end of this cycle. So if I was worried, for example, am I reading the correct dest for my jump instruction? Well, I can look at this jump instruction, see it's a jump to address 13. I can look at my dest wire and say, oh, yep, I am. And if I wasn't, this would help me like figure out, okay, did I get that part wrong or was I using the dest incorrectly? So this is handy for actually debugging when you make mistakes in your processor. So in addition to the minus D option, debug or dash D option, there's also an interactive option, or dash I. And what that does is after every cycle, it just prompts you to press enter to continue. So you can just single step through your processor, which you might find convenient. You could also just run the whole thing, redirect the output to a file, and read that file later. And as I mentioned earlier, there's also a dash quiet option, which just runs it until it finishes and doesn't tell us anything. Yes?
What are the different stat values for like
all the What are the different stats values you can pass to stat?
No, like stat set to 1 there?
Yes. So the question is, where would we figure out what the stat values are? So in the web page we have for HCLRS, we have we have a list of code which is put constants which are defined beforehand, and you can look in here to figure out all the stat values are. You also can see what all the constants we define for your comparing opcodes, for comparing condition codes, and so on. We'll talk about the stuff down here probably next time, or maybe a little bit today. Yeah, so let's talk about like more formally. So yes, first talk about differences from the book. So in the book, they use bool or int. We just call them all wires. Bools are just one bit wires. The books uses names like valc, and in the book's implementation, students did not have a real choice of what names they use. We don't have that restriction. If you don't like any of the book's names, you can ignore them and use your own. But the book uses names like valc, which were required in their implementation. RMUXes must have a default case. So you have to have some sort of default on every MUX. Even if you do think it's not reachable, you still have to have it. And we have you implement your own ALU. In the book, the ALU is a supplied component here. You just write a MUX with the appropriate expressions to make the ALU. Rather than having it be a pre-supplied thing, which gives you more flexibility, so because you don't have to use some pre-supplied ALU to do +8, for example. So let's talk about components in HTLRS just more formally. So one of them, we saw register banks, so I'm going to go through that in more detail. So I mentioned these before. We have an input and an output register letter, and we can have multiple registers defined in what's called a register bank. Each of them has an input signal prefixed with the input letter and an output signal prefixed with the output letter. And they have a width in bits. This width you assign must agree if you're taking a subset of the instruction, for example. And they have an initial value, which you must supply. You cannot have a register without an initial value. And there's some other signals associated with register banks we'll talk about later in the semester. So questions on register banks. So another thing that we have in HTRS expansion was wires, which are kind of like variables. And a wire is the name HTLRS uses for anything which can have a signal. Some of them are implicit, so like that X underscore input to the register, that's a wire. And like I10 bytes is a wire, it's just already connected for you to the instruction memory, so you can't connect something to it. Assignment you can think of as connecting two wires together. You can only have one value assigned to a wire, but you can use its value multiple times. So an important thing about how wires work in HTLRS is that order doesn't matter. That the wire is connected or it's not, everything happens in the cycle, and the interpreter will figure out what order that values propagate, so they're set up by the end of the cycle. Just like in a real circuit, you have two wires connected, the value's going to flow when it's there. So these two programs here, they're the same. Even though in one case we seem to be assigning valp, before it's used, and the other we seem to be assigning after, they're the same. In both cases, the valp that goes into the PC input is this valp. Because all the assignments occur every cycle. And they're not ordered, they just happen. So when we look here and say, what's valp, you have to look down here and say, oh, that's what it is, even though it's not in order. Which is why registers have a different input and output. Okay, questions about order? And one last thing about wires is wires have widths. You have to have widths agree when you assign between wires. And we'll finish up reviewing this next time, and we'll talk about the one big thing we're missing, which is what about memory and the register file? So we'll talk about how we actually deal with that in HCLRS, and then we'll move back to talking about building single cycle processors.